Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Howdy everyone, this is Risky Business and I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Microsoft, makers of Solitaire, Notepad and Paintbrush, among other such enterprise software. Risky.biz is hosted by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting at discounted rates, so a big thank you to those guys. And on this week's show, we're taking a look at DECT hacking. Now, DECT stands for the Digital Enhanced Cordless Telecommunication Standard. It's the protocol that makes your cordless phone work. And as you'll hear soon, it is absolutely wide open in most cases, and there's all sorts of funky stuff you can do with it. So Blair Strang, who's a bit of a DECT enthusiast, will be along soon to discuss DECT hacking. We'll also be checking in with James Pratt from Microsoft in this week's sponsor interview. James is the Internet Explorer product manager. He's a bit of a bigwig, and he's dropping by to tell us what's changed in IE in its latest incarnation. But first up, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with a special guest this week, the host of the Paul.com security podcast, Paul Assadorian. And Paul, we've got a terrific story to get into to start with, courtesy of the Australian Financial Review. It quotes the Reserve Bank of Australia, which is Australia's Fed, if you will, as saying that credit card fraud, that is card-not-present fraud, has actually gone up by 50% over the last year. Now, that's got to make you question the effectiveness of PCI, given that we're already a fair way down that road.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting. I was listening, I think it was Martin McKay from the Network Security Podcast just today, and he was talking about, and I definitely identify with this, you know, PCI kind of gives you a snapshot. Even if it's a regular snapshot, it's still kind of a snapshot in time of maybe just some of the software vulnerabilities that exist within your system. But he was saying, you know, to really secure your web applications in your web environment, he's like, that can take upwards of like 3 or 4 or 5 years before you develop your software development life cycle. You build in the appropriate processes, you train your end users, you train your developers, and you build your tools to, you know, and you keep up with your changing code. It's like all that takes a lot of time. And I think that's something that really one of the big things that PCI is really missing is that it's all about process. And in the case of building and maintaining a secure web application, that can just take so much time.
Paul, to be honest, I mean, I just think PCI is hands down a really stupid idea. The fact that we've got all of this information, this very simple information, strings of digits and names and expiry dates and stuff, that can actually be used to authorize transactions. And then we're taking that information and splattering it around amongst all of these separate merchants. It's just bound to fail. I can't say I'm surprised by this, and I really think that what we are seeing is an accelerating problem that, regardless of changes to PCI, it's still going to get worse, and it's going to get to the point where we have to start considering that we need to look at a different way of doing transactions online.
I'm certainly not going to sit here and try and defend PCI by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, I think that we need to start looking at more advanced forms of authentication, you know, better design of our web applications to take into consideration the kinds of transactions that are happening and the kinds of attacks that are being launched at our website. And that it's all not just about making sure, you know, maybe there's no vulnerabilities or there's a code review done every once in a while, but, you know, take into account that the user is going to click on everything and they're not going to have a good password. And how do we fix that problem?
And Norton won't save them. And I think the point is, mate, that we don't solve that problem because it's too bloody big. What we can do, though, is we can secure transactional information at one point, which is the bank. So instead of giving someone your credit card number, you go to the bank and you say, I want to pay that merchant that money. You know, I think I'm long overdue to write some big, long, ranty opinion piece about that, so I'll see if I can get cracking on that this week, over the next week. Now, we better move on, because we could talk about this all day. And one thing that's actually created quite a buzz, which is surprising to me, is this new tool that HP have released for Flash developers. It's basically a reverse engineering tool for Flash files. And, you know, even though a big vendor released it, it's actually turned out to be pretty good.
Yeah, and it's exactly what you state. You know, it takes the binary code that exists in a Flash object and it translates that right into source code. And I downloaded it and played with it very briefly today, and it works phenomenally well.
Yeah, look, I've heard heaps of people say that. Yeah.
You know, we always talk about our good friend Bob, you know, on the Paul.com show, and he got a chance to play around with it. And Bob's that, you know, one of those guys that does all those evil and nefarious things and then tells us about them. And Bob ran it against some random sites on the internet today, and he found those sites by using a little bit of Google querying to look for login.swf. This would be a Flash application that accepts a login, a username and password, or even just a password. And he analyzed some of them. And what he told me was that you would be surprised as to how many of these Flash applications actually embed the password directly in the Flash object. So when you authenticate, it's comparing the password you enter against something that's stored inside of the Flash object. It's kind of like, well, you know, I'm a binary file, so there's really nothing to see here, and you could never see the password that's stored inside of me. And here we go, HP releases a tool to do just that. And that's just one use case that we're hearing about happening with this tool.
As an editor of mine once said, can open, worms everywhere. And I want you to just hear one thing, which is this. That was the sound of me slapping my forehead over this, because I would suspect that it's going to be a party out there with people actually going buck wild with this thing. But holy moly, I can't believe what you just told me about that that login.swift app. You know?
It's interesting, and we see this a lot in the computer security realm. You know, people think that other people aren't looking, and even though we may not think of this particular attack vector, I'm sure someone else has.
Yeah.
And they've been using this attack vector for a long time, and then like, all it takes is someone for release a tool or an article or a research paper, and everyone's like, oh my God, like this is really bad, and you know, hopefully things start to get fixed. But
I bet there's a lot of very upset gray hats out there right now.
Exactly. It's just people going, no, I've been using this for so long. Now everybody knows about it.
Yes. Now, look, we've got to switch mode here a little bit, because the next bit of news that we're discussing is quite sad, which is that, excuse me, Jack C. Lewis, who is of Outpost 24, who is also the author of, what was it, Unicorn Scan?
Oh, yeah, I did read this article. Yeah, the author of Unicorn Scan. Yeah, he passed away.
Yeah, he died in a house fire in Sweden. I think it was around a week ago, or maybe a little bit longer.
Is that what happened?
Yeah, it is, and it's tremendously sad. I never knew Jack. I'd never met him. I had some dealings with Robert E. Lee, who was his business partner. So these are the guys who wrote Sockstress, which was that TCP denial of service thing a while ago. And I got to say, I know several guys who knew Jack, and they all spoke tremendously highly of him. You know, condolences to all. It's very sad. I mean, yeah, what can you say? It's just someone who's quite young. Has tremendous respect amongst their peers. Very well regarded for both their personality and their intelligence. To die that way, it's tremendously sad. And unfortunately, there's been another death in the industry here in Australia, where the former regional director of Checkpoint, Scott Ferguson, who I have met on several occasions, he actually died earlier this month. He had faced a fairly drawn out battle with cancer, so he was. He was with Checkpoint from May 2002 to 2008 as the Asia Pacific Vice President and Australia New Zealand Managing Director. And he's survived by his wife, Kate, and sons, Simon, Callum, and Thomas. And of course, our condolences to them. A request has been made that instead of sending flowers, mourners make a donation to the Bill Walsh Cancer Research Laboratories. Yes, Scott was 58. So that's also some very sad news there.
Yeah, certainly my condolences go out to both those gentlemen's friends and family. It's certainly very sad when we hear about people who are doing great things in our field, certainly passing away before their prime, you know, while they're in their prime.
So anyway, look, we can't dwell on it forever. So we should just move on to the next story, which is that Joanna Rutkowska's latest research is quite interesting, which was about getting ring 2 or ring minus 2 access by exploiting system management memory on some Intel boards to plant stealthy rootkits. Now, we also saw some similar research come from the guys at Core Security Technologies which is about planting very stealthy and very persistent malware into BIOS.
Yeah, and I think both of the pieces of research that have come out recently certainly have, I think, changed the playing field when it comes to keeping access. You know, we scan systems, we enumerate, we compromise systems, you know, we escalate privileges on systems. But at the end of the day, even as penetration testers, and certainly when it comes to, you know, black hats who are trying to maintain botnets, keeping access is, you know, one of the most important things. And here are some methods that we see from, you know, very similar research that even if you wipe the hard drive, reinstall the operating system, you still get reinfected. Now, it does require that your system actually become compromised in the first place, but, you know, here's a method where your actual hardware is infected, and until you reload the firmware on the hardware, which in some cases may not even be possible or extremely difficult, your machine is going to remain infected. So, like, what do we do now? Do we just be like, well, your system got pwned, so here's a new computer, and now we have to throw this one in the trash and stomp it into little pieces?
Now, look, I've been really keen to ask you about this next story, actually, because there's been a new botnet uncovered, which is comprised completely of hacked consumer-grade routers. Now, you've had considerable experience with OpenWRT, and you know a lot about this sort of stuff. So you actually warned that this was going to happen, didn't you?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I gave a presentation. The last time I gave it was October 2008, before I, you know, kind of retired it and said that, you know, I'm moving on to something else. But in that presentation is kind of a follow-on to some of the research we're doing, the book that we wrote on hacking the Linksys WRT54G routers. I talked about some of the benefits or advantages that you have when you compromise something like a consumer-grade embedded device or even any other kind of embedded device on the network versus an actual system. And one of the things that always popped out at me was, hey, you know, a lot of people, okay, millions of people, and maybe just about everyone connected to a high-speed internet connection has one of these DSL routers, has one of these embedded systems that run Linux. Wouldn't it be great if we could compromise those and be able to sniff all of the traffic on their connection and be able to, you know, send down a DNS server to them? And one of the advantages that I always thought was fascinating was that if you compromise someone's router, you can now own a device that they have very little interaction with, right? You can do things on that router and they're not going to notice because it's not their desktop. It's not something they're interacting with every day. It sits in a corner, it collects dust, and people only typically interact with it when things go wrong. So if you can keep the system up and running and passing traffic, you can pretty much have carte blanche on that system and all the traffic going through it, which is really all we care about anyway, right? We really care about the information that's contained on your computer, and more importantly, when it's transmitted over the network. And if we own the embedded device, then we own that information.
Yeah, now, look, I agree. This is a really hard one to actually clean up. That's what makes it concerning to me. It's not like Microsoft can issue some sort of magic zappy right thing through their, you know, malicious software removal tool. It's not like, you know, a patch or antivirus software is going to get rid of this one. This is a terrific idea on behalf of the Black Hats, I've got to say. It basically tries to log in using brute force techniques through SSHD or TelnetD, and then basically checks to see if it's on the type of class of device that it can infect, and then it infects it and then obviously spreads. So it's a proper old school worm style attack vector, and it's been dubbed Cybot, and no one really quite knows how big it is, but it's been big enough to DDoS the guys at DroneBL or at least give them a run for their money. So yeah, this is a pretty serious issue, and yeah, it's an interesting one. I'm surprised it's taken till now before we've seen it.
What a perfect way to own a persistent botnet. You know, there's all kinds of things. I think a lot of the embedded devices are increasing in processing power too, which gives them a little more computing power and makes it a little more attractive for a botnet as well.
Now, we had one story about that where we gave HP a pat on the back and talked about how awesome they are. Now we're going to talk about how woefully crap they are, because their OpenView system, there's just been a whole bunch of holes plugged in OpenView. And, you know, I'm consistently hearing from penetration testers out there that if you really want to own a network at sort of stage two of a pen test, you target their network management gear and it always falls over.
The network management system typically has certainly insight into the network, and a lot of times, you know, credentials on many of the systems and the ability to even send down configuration to all of the devices connected to the network. So, you know, may have a network with maybe it has 5,000 routers in a really large environment. If they're using something like OpenView or whatever tool they're using to manage their routers, if you compromise that one system, well, that gives you the access to change the configuration to 5,000 routers. And what's better than that?
And that's exactly what the guys at Core Labs found. They found three vulnerabilities in HP OpenView NNM, which is Network Node Manager, that can be exploited remotely via buffer overflows to compromise mission-critical servers. So hooray for HP. It would be really nice if this management software wasn't so shatter-prone, but I'm just hearing from everyone I know that this stuff is where the bugs are at the moment, and it's a little bit of a worry.
I think a lot of it stems from, you know, people still have that mentality that, well, this application is going to run on the inside of the network, so I'm not too concerned about it. And what I've, you know, always tried to preach is that, you know, the inside and the outside of your network is the same thing. Because there's so many ways to get on your network. You know,
there is no perimeter. There is no spoon.
Yeah, exactly. I always push, you know, people who I'm giving advice to and my clients and such, I'm like, look, take your network, and then when you think about securing it, secure it from the inside out. And that's how we end up with vulnerabilities like this, because people aren't thinking like that. They're thinking, well, you know, this enterprise-level application, it only runs on the inside of my network, so I don't need to secure it. I don't need to lock it down, and I don't need to be concerned, you know, if there's buffer overflow, so I'm not even going to go really look for any there. And, props to the guys at Core for having the insight to do that.
It's funny you say that, because most people I know would recommend going from the perimeter and working their way in, but, you know. Okay, just quickly, we're running out of time, but IP tables is out and NF tables is in.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of this before. You know, I think that IP tables is great, and certainly the replacement looks to be pretty neat, a little more tightly integrated with the kernel. Sounds like they're going for a little more performance increase when they were designing this particular rewrite. I've always wanted to upgrade my firewall on my network and replace it with an embedded system running Linux with some kind of IP tables firewall, because I think that technology is absolutely great. So, you know, this looks to be even better, so I can't wait to play around with it.
Yeah, now we can't say, too, that it's just some whippersnapper who's whipped this up. It's a guy called Patrick McCarty, who, of course, has been maintaining IP tables. So this is the guy, and it looks like this is the next extension, NF tables, which could make things, a little bit interesting for people out there who do a lot with Linux firewalls. Now, in our final story for the week, Paul, whew, getting there. In this report by CNETnews.com, written by Eleanor Mills, they've actually put a dollar figure on the amount of money being made by these guys who sell dodgy antivirus applications. You know, the rogue ones that say, you're infected, you've got to install our software, give us your credit card number. Those guys.
I hate those guys.
Yeah.
You know, the antivirus software now, the software that pretends to be antivirus software but is really the malware, in this case, it can completely take over your system and embed itself so deep that you can't even think about running antivirus software, let alone even browse to an antivirus vendor's website. And how do I know this? Well, you know, one of my systems in my honeypot in my lab got infected last year.
The honeypot lab system, is that code for your wife's computer?
I can neither confirm nor deny.
But I'm sorry.
Yeah,
please
actually, it was, you know, one of my systems here in the house. I clicked on a link and I knew it instantly when it happened. And you know, started analyzing the what the malware was doing, and it was really, really nasty. And you know, I was talking to some of the other guys about it, and they had seen similar instances of, you know, some of this malware, and it's so nasty. You have to just like immediately format and reinstall.
Yep. Now, Fingen, who did this research, say that these guys are making about $10,800 US dollars each day.
That's unbelievable.
I think we're in the wrong business, my friend.
I think so.
And mate, that takes us to the end of this week's news segment. Thank you very much for coming in and doing a special guest appearance.
Thanks, Patrick.
Paul.com's Paul Asadorian on the line there with a look at this week's news headlines. And friends of Jack C. Lewis who wish to pay their respects can do so at St. Simon and Jude Church in Huntington Beach, California, from 10 to 11 a.m. on Friday, May 1. Now, look, in happier news, this week on our new site, risky.biz, you can have a read of Metal Storm's latest column in which he gets heckled by CIOs over breakfast. It's very funny stuff. We still haven't set up SSL on the new site. Sorry about that, but it should be coming in the next few days. But I should mention that we are running a competition to celebrate the launch of risky.biz. Now, in Australia, Australian law forbids me from giving away stuff based on a game of chance. So we'll just make the competition about who has the best username as selected by a panel made up of, I don't know, my friend's toddler, my pet budgerigar, and my mate Kahu. I don't know, why not? So therefore, it's a game of skill and it doesn't violate any laws. To win, all you need to do is sign up for an account on risky.biz. But there is a catch. You need to fill in all of the information, like employer, job title, and all that jazz. Now, the reason I'm asking you guys to do that is because advertisers these days, they really want to know what sort of job titles that the listeners have, you know, and to stay afloat in these tough economic times. It's something that we can't ignore anymore. We really need better information on who you guys are out there, hence the competition. As for the prizes, I bought out of my own pocket a couple of RFID kits. So they're RFID writer readers and some cards for you to hack away at. I believe I've got two of them. And if the winner is like reckons their game, you can actually hack these things to turn them into, you know, you can do man in the middle with them and stuff. And they're very cool, you know, prox card stuff. We've also got a couple of sweet little toolkits courtesy of Microsoft Forefront Security. And the grand prize is an Asus EPC 1000H in your choice of black or white. It comes with 160 gigabytes of storage and 1 gig of RAM. And the main prize comes to you courtesy of Kaspersky. So a big thank you to Kaspersky. I'm sorry also to say that you need to be based in Australia or New Zealand to be eligible to win the prizes, but that shouldn't discourage you from signing up, okay? Now, on to this week's feature story now, and as I mentioned at the intro, we'll be talking about DECT hacking. DECT is, of course, the Digital Enhanced Cordless Telecommunications Standard, and as it turns out, it's absolutely full of holes because people haven't implemented it properly. Gee, where have we heard that before? Now, thanks to some research by a team at Dedected.org and some others, it's now possible to snoop on around 50% of calls carried over DECT phones. And even worse, it looks increasingly likely that it's possible to seize control of DECT base stations and start making free calls. I'm told a handset that's capable of doing this is just around the corner. DECT hacking has become a bit of a hobby for our next guest, Blair Strang. I interviewed him a couple of days ago.
Originally, cordless phones were analog, so you could, wander down the street with your handheld scanner, and you'd pick up all sorts of phone calls. But in the early 90s, I think it's ETSI, the European Telecommunications Standard Institute, came up with a standard for digital cordless telephony, and that standard was DECT. So instead of your voice data being transmitted in an analog fashion, it's transmitted digitally. So the phone buffers up maybe 10 milliseconds worth of audio, and then it squirts it out in a short burst, which reaches the base station.
And is that encrypted at all, or was security a part of this standard when they first came up with the idea?
Well, actually it was. There are two parts to DECT security. One is DSAA, which is the DECT standard authentication algorithm, and that's supposed to govern, for example, when I pick up my handset, I expect that I'll be connected to my line and not my neighbour's line.
Yep.
So the other side of DECT security is the DSC, and that's the DECT standard cipher. So, yeah, there were provisions in the standard for encryption and authentication of phones.
Were they ever actually implemented?
Well, there's been some recent awesome research dropped by these guys at Dedected.org, and they're a German outfit. They've essentially developed a new way of attacking DECT by changing the firmware on a particular kind of PCMCIA/PCI card.
Okay, so is this some sort of DECT slot card that you can buy?
Right. So I think the product, I think, was a bit of a failure, and the idea behind it was that you'd buy this card, you'd plug it in, and you'd use your existing DECT phones, but this card would act as a base station for you, so it would trunk them out as VoIP.
Oh, okay. I can see why that would be a good idea.
Yeah, okay. So what they did was they grabbed one of these cards and then they hacked the firmware up. And these firmware hacks allowed them to develop a DECT sniffer, among other things.
So what would you actually get with a DECT sniffer? I take it you're talking about sort of content interception there, like i.e. listening in on people's calls.
Right. Well, at a very low level, you can see the digital data which is transmitted and received by the fixed and portable parts. So if you like, that's at a level where most hackers can go to town, if you like. You're seeing the bitstream now, and you don't have to worry about any of the analog radio stuff underneath. And that does allow interception of calls if DSC and DSAA aren't implemented. And one of the discoveries they made once they'd had a DECT sniffer and they could get access to these bitstreams is that, yeah, a lot of phones don't enable the encryption. They don't enable the authentication.
So, like, as a percentage of the consumer devices that are out there, you're saying that a significant proportion of them never actually implemented the security component of the DECT standard?
That's right, yeah. I think it would be about 50-50 based on the stats I've seen so far.
Well, they're pretty good odds.
Ha!
Now, let me ask you, if DSC, I believe that's the cipher, isn't it? If that is actually implemented correctly, is it still possible to intercept the calls? I mean, is the cipher weak? Is it strong? Is it useful? Can it be tricked?
The dedector.org guys have done some cryptanalysis of it, but so far it's looking pretty good. I think they had some results against reduced round variants. But, yeah, if it were all implemented properly, then, yeah, it would be great.
Now, where I think this gets really interesting is you can actually start doing some pretty evil stuff to DECT base stations, like actually just walking down the street with your laptop with one of these cards in it and then basically just hijacking someone else's DECT base station and making calls from it.
Right, and the only thing which I believe is getting in the way of that at the moment is that the dedector.org guys haven't released transmit firmware for their PCMCIA card yet. So I think that's really a matter of time, if you like.
So there's no theoretical limitation on doing this. It's just a question of whether or not these guys are going to release the code.
To be honest, I think it's only a matter of time before someone does it.
Mm-hmm. So do you think these guys are holding back, perhaps, because they don't want to be responsible for making, you know, every second DECT base station out there a target for modern-day freakers?
That's a really good question. I did wonder that. I see in their slides and in their timeline that they did intend to drop it, so there might be technical reasons. They might be holding back because someone put a hard word on them. Or, you know,
so they have actually mentioned that they've been able to develop that capability.
Yeah, I wasn't 100% sure when I saw that whether, okay, because one of the attacks that you can do is that you can set up your own base station, and this often works even if the crypto is good. You can set up your own base station with radio fixed power identifier of, let's say, my neighbor's base station. And if I give a better signal, then their handset will lock onto me. That's due to a common problem, which is that although the base station is authenticating the handset and the crypto is set up fine,
the handset doesn't authenticate the base station.
Right, exactly like, yeah. If you like, original GSM 900.
Yeah, yeah. Now, is this something that you can fix within the confines of the DECT standard? So, you know, can you actually use the DECT standard to force the handsets to authenticate the base station, or is that just something that was overlooked?
It's in the standard. It just seems that no one does it properly.
So really, you can then very easily man-in-the-middle people's calls and effectively run a line tap on them sitting out the front of their house.
Pretty much, yeah.
Oh, that's fun. So I've heard that you've played around with this quite extensively. What's your own playtime in regard to DECT yielded for you? I mean, what have you found doing this stuff?
It's pretty easy to get into this DECT space. All you need is maybe a 50-euro PCMCIA card that you can get off eBay, a laptop, and a pile of phones, which is pretty easy to get by going to, say, Trade Me and bidding on every phone that's out there for $1.
That's what you guys use in New Zealand instead of eBay.
Yeah, that's the one, yeah. Okay.
I just could almost hear all of the Americans out there in podcast land going, Trade Me, what the hell's that?
Right, yeah, I forget there's the rest of the world.
Yeah. So right, you get your pile of phones, you get your DECT card, and then what do you do?
Well, the first thing you do is you decide which ones of them have crypto and which ones don't. And so I'm compiling like a little list of that at the moment. And what I'm really interested in is getting the transmit feature working.
Well, yeah, I can imagine you would be. Are you having any luck?
Not really, but it's definitely possible. I want transmit so that I can A, demonstrate hijacking of base stations, and B, it would be really quite fun to walk down the street and maybe just ring the phones that are in range.
So make all your neighbours' handsets go off at the same time.
Yeah, I think that would be a good way to demonstrate the insecurity of this protocol.
Well, it would be fun.
Yeah.
So I guess my other question about this stuff is, you know, what I find particularly interesting about this, a lot of people use, open Wi-Fi to conceal their point of entry into someone's network. I'm curious to see if you can actually stream data over a DECT connection. I imagine it would be quite difficult because of that 10 millisecond buffer. Have you played around with that at all?
I haven't personally played with that, but it's using the... You get quite good QoS with DECT, and it's using, I think, the G726 codec. Normally you get a 32 kbit channel, which means that you should be able to run maybe a 2400 baud modem with it.
So really, if you were just doing stuff with SSH and whatnot, it would be theoretically possible for you to actually use a dial-in account from, you know, using a modem connection over someone else's DECT base station.
Actually, yeah, you could do that.
That's pretty sneaky. And I imagine there would be some sort of fraud possibility, some things that you alluded to earlier.
If you perhaps owned a pay-per-minute call number, then I suppose that by moving around town and dialing through open base stations, then you could, that does represent a potential for fraud.
So really all you'd need to do is set up some sort of fake sex line. And then really go around and make all these DECT base stations ring it for 20 minutes. And then when they go to the telecommunications authorities and say, I never made that call, they're like, sure you didn't, buddy.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
Well, that is interesting. And I imagine also that you might even be able to get some traction. I mean, have you done any DECT war driving?
I have, yeah.
And what's it like? I mean, how many open DECT base stations would you find somewhere like? You're based in Auckland, aren't you?
I'm based in Wellington.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, walking through the Wellington CBD, did you find many open DECT base stations?
Hundreds.
Hundreds. So I imagine also, I mean, one of the things that's proven quite popular over the years in the area of PBX hacking is these calling card scams. And you know, people are using hacked PBXs to do that, but I imagine it would be quite simple to do that with DECT as well.
I suppose you could, but you might need a bit more of a setup. For example, to really run a calling card operation, you'd want to trunk through maybe a lot of different lines.
Yeah, but I mean, you could hook that up, couldn't you?
Yeah, it's definitely possible.
For the right dollars.
you could resell your neighbour's phone service.
So, you mentioned that you're actually looking at all different models of phones. Have you found that there are certain brands that are better? Is it a case of the name brand stuff being much better, like, you know, Sony instead of Sony and all of those, you know, Chinese knockoffs and whatnot? Are the bigger brands better, is what I'm asking?
Not that I've found. It does tend to vary by model, by model as well as manufacturer. One thing I should point out is that I don't think anyone's done any work with the 2.4 gig WDECT equipment yet.
Is that a newer standard, is it, or...?
No, it's not a newer standard. It just uses a different band. So normal DECT is 1880 to 1900 megahertz.
Mm.
This stuff is 2.4 gig. So just simply because these cards and various other equipment don't work in the 2.4 gig range, you've sort of got a bit of security by obscurity for a while.
Yeah, okay. So you'd recommend that until those cards start coming out, people out there in listener land might want to consider using handsets on the 2.4 gig band.
Yeah, it does have a downside, though, because they can interfere with your Wi-Fi.
Ah, yay.
Yeah.
So one thing I'm curious about, though, is whether or not DECT has made any sort of inroads into business or if it's still very much a consumer standard.
That's a good question. I'm told that there are large DECT PABX operations, although I haven't specifically seen one.
So when you're in the CBD, it's typically just the smaller businesses and stuff who may have one or two lines coming into their premises.
What happens is when you're war driving around, what you pick up is RFPIs, radio fixed part identifiers.
Mm-hmm.
So as part of the DECT standard, every so often they'll transmit a beacon saying, I am here, and that's what the portables lock onto. So So in your little Kismet window, you see the IDs of various systems which are around. Now, if there were some kind of a crazy large PABX, without sitting there and dumping the frames from that fixed part, you wouldn't know it from a single base station in someone's house.
So you'd really need to sniff the traffic and see if there were, 10 calls going on at the same time. So can you actually pass multiple calls through one decked base station?
Yeah, it's available in the standard.
Okay, right. Well, that's pretty interesting, isn't it? I mean, it would certainly give... I mean, if there were CSOs out there or CIOs getting pitched, some sort of decked PBX solution, you'd probably think twice given the nature of this research, wouldn't you?
I would say so, yeah.
Mm.
You'd want some pretty good assurances from your vendor that they had, in fact, implemented the security properly.
Mm.
Because for years, the vendors have been claiming that decked is secure, while clearly it was not.
So long-term, do you think the manufacturers should be moving away from decked, or do you think they should just be looking at using the security that's built into the standard?
I think that they should implement the security which is built into the standard. It is a good protocol. It doesn't have any of the QoS issues that you have trying to use the 2.4 gig band and share it with other devices. It's a mature standard, and actually decked has a little band just on its own. So that part is good. It reduces interference.
So really what I'm taking away from this conversation is that it is definitely possible to enable this transmit thing and do man in the middle and also seize the base stations and make calls from them. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
Blair Strang, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, mate.
Blair Strang on the line from New Zealand there. Thanks, Blair, for your time. It's time for this week's sponsor interview now, and Risky Business makes its money by selling these sponsored interviews, and this week we're pleased to have James Pratt on the show. He's Microsoft's Internet Explorer product manager, and he joins me now from a buzzier phone line than usual. Sorry about that. So, James, can you tell me what's changed in IE8 that will be of interest to the listeners out there in security land?
Absolutely. So, I mean, let's start with the kind of browser itself. Of course, as with almost all Microsoft products, we use the secure development lifecycle, which, is, I think, kind of reasonably well understood at this point. But that means that we spend a lot of time carefully reviewing the code, trying to eliminate, kind of buffer overflows and such like. But we've also done some things around, some of the common attack vectors, in the browser around ActiveX. Now, ActiveX, of course, is a necessary, kind of part of the fabric of the web, right? And, it enables things like, Flash and other things like that, but it's also used, in enterprise line of business applications pretty often. And, when I speak to IT administrators, they often, kind of ask me for, how can we get more control? How can we reduce, ActiveX attack surface? So we did a few things in IE8 around ActiveX. We introduced two new features called per user and per site ActiveX, which basically reduce the scope that an ActiveX control can run in. So you think of kind of per user. The example I always give is if you on your PC were to go to the Dell website, for example, and the Dell website were to download an ActiveX control that uploads information about your PC to the web. You've taken a conscious decision to install that control, but that control would also be available for somebody else who came and logged onto your PC. And so we introduced per user ActiveX as a way of saying, just the user that installs an ActiveX control, is the only person who by default gets that ActiveX control. In other words, if some other user comes along, they're also then prompted, like, do you want to allow this control to run? So that's per user ActiveX. Per site ActiveX kind of does the same thing, across different sites. For example, if, when you install the Dell control, IE8 will ask you, hey, do you want to run this on all websites? Do you want to run it only on this website? And it allows the control scope again to be reduced so that the Dell control only runs on the Dell website. We also actually had a feature in IE7 called SiteLock, which was basically an ATL template that people could use when they build ActiveX controls to very, tightly specify that my control is only, supposed to run on one site. And then the last thing, we've enabled DepNX by default for ActiveX controls in IE8, as long as you're running, I think it's Vista SP1 or higher. So we've done a lot of work around the browser, itself, to kind of reduce, the attack surface as much as possible. And I think that, that answers some of the questions certainly that I get from IT professionals.
Now, what about administrability? I don't think that's a word, but I'm going to use it anyway. What have you guys done to actually make this thing more easy to manage? I mean, can you, for example, if you're an administrator, can you just suddenly disable certain features, plugins, JavaScript, stuff like that from some sort of centralized console? And is that different from IE7? Because I wouldn't have the foggiest.
I would say, and I'll come straight out with it. I think really Microsoft is the only company who builds a browser and thinks about enterprise needs. And, across IE6, IE7, IE8, we've always had very broad support for group policy. So if you're an IT administrator, you can, control, many parts of the browser. You can turn features on and off. You can change things like the security zones and make sure that the browser really kind of meets the compliance and security policies of your organization and then enforce those through group policy. In IE8, we have more than, I think now 1400 group policies, available. Now, if you're going to go roll out, another browser, like, for example, Firefox, you get no group policy support out of the box. Now, there is actually a plugin for Firefox that you can get, but it only gives about, 15 group policies. And so really, IE8's the only browser that has this really broad support for, administering and enforcing policy.
So you have actually significantly altered the extent to which Internet Explorer is administrable.
Yeah, I mean, we've increased the number of group policies by more than 100 for IE8. So we introduced new features. I mean, let me give you an example. We introduced a cross-site scripting filter, which is a security feature. And there's a group policy which would allow an IT professional to switch that on or off. Obviously, we very much hope that, IT pros leave it on. It's on by default. But if for some reason, you wanted to switch that off, you could. Same with, we have new features like accelerators and web slices, which are kind of end user features. And as an IT pro or a security guy, you might want to switch those features off, or you might want to lock down the list of accelerators and web slices that people can use. And you can do that through group policy. So, we've really made sure that everything that's new we've shipped in the browser, we're providing group policies for. And then also the group policies that, when we talk to, IT pros and security people, and they say, hey, it would be great if there was a group policy to do kind of X. We've tried to do that. And let me give you a kind of concrete example of that. And when we shipped IE7, we made some changes to the UI. We moved the stop and refresh buttons from their location on the left of the address bar to the right of the address bar. Now, it sounds like a really kind of small change.
Yeah, but you're going to freak out the users, man.
Absolutely. Freak out the users. And IT organizations kept saying, like, why did you guys move things? Like, my users now can't find stop and refresh.
You just tripled our help desk support costs.
Absolutely. And so we introduced a new feature in IE8 where there's an option that you can switch to move those buttons back to their original location. And we exposed it by group policy. So you can just kind of set it and roll it out across your entire organization. We also ship a tool called the IEAK, the Internet Explorer Administration Kit, which basically allows an IT pro or a security person to kind of preset a bunch of settings in IE for their organization and ship their own kind of customized IE8 package, perhaps with their company's homepage set as the default. So there's a kind of when you're in the planning phase of your deployment, there's a tool that you can use to kind of prep your package before launch. And one of the great things about IE8 from an IT perspective is that you can now slipstream it into a Vista image, which means basically, when you're building your standard desktop image, you can, in kind of 15 or so minutes, add IE8, into that image. So, your users don't have to worry about updating through automatic update, or you don't have to do a, system center config manager, job to run later to kind of add IE8. It's right there in the image. And that's significantly better than IE7, because in IE7, let's say you wanted to add it to Windows XP, you had to kind of build your whole image, let it install, let it boot, capture the image using, maybe a kind of piece of ghost technology, install IE7, reboot the machine, recapture the image. It was a very kind of time-consuming process. It would take hours. So we've made it very quick and easy for IT pros to integrate IE8 into their standard Vista desktop image.
Well, I also understand that IE8 is the first Internet Explorer. It'll be shipping with Windows 7, but you don't actually have to use it, do you? It's not actually an integral part of the OS.
You know, there's a good blog posting on the Windows blog that kind of explains our thinking behind that decision. So, definitely I would encourage your listeners to go out there and visit the Windows blog, and there's a post up there that talks, about our thinking behind that.
So you've got a cross-site scripting filter built into, obviously you would be trying to knock out stuff like cross-site request forgery as well, wouldn't you?
The cross-site scripting filter is specifically targeted at cross-site scripting type 1 reflection attacks. And so, that's an attack where basically it's a kind of attempt to insert JavaScript into a web page. And so we kind of look for that characteristic, JavaScript being passed in as a parameter, and, then that same JavaScript appearing in the body of the page, because, the website has got, a vulnerability, and they're just kind of, they're just kind of blindly rendering whatever they get as a parameter into the page. And so we look for that, and we actually kind of block the attack by, it's actually kind of simple, but just putting a hash mark in the script tag header so the script is no longer recognized as valid script. The interesting thing about, for me at least, about the cross-site scripting filter is we protect against that attack without actually affecting the functionality of the page. So in other words, it's not just a kind of blanket block all JavaScript, from running on the page, activity. It's a very kind of surgical remove the bad bit of JavaScript that was inserted.
Mm-hmm.
And there's if anyone wants to go try, the cross-site scripting filter out, you can see a kind of, in inverted commas, safe example. We host a website called IE8demos.com. I think if you go to IE8demos.com/XSS, you can see a kind of email message there that kind of starts a cross-site scripting attack on another website that we've published. You can actually kind of see the attack in action. And you can also go run that in other browsers, and you can see how, other browsers, when you try and log in, your username, your password is reflected off to this, hacker somewhere else on the internet. But in IE8, we're able to detect that attack and neutralize it.
Okay, James Pratt, thank you very much for speaking to Risky Business.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Microsoft's James Pratt on the line from the USA there in this week's sponsor interview. Thanks to Microsoft again for sponsoring this program. Normally at this point we'd go to a check of this week's audio mailbag, but alas, no one felt the love this week. We didn't get a single message to our Sydney or USA numbers. If you'd like to comment on anything you've heard in Risky Business or suggest something you'd like to hear on the show, you can call Sydney 02-8569 1835 or USA toll free on 877-688-8417. But as for this week, we're done. I hope you'll get into the risky.biz forums and let us know what you thought of this week's show, or any of the printed content on the site for that matter. We've got a piece about Mac malware up there, MetalStorm's latest column, which is a bit of fun, and also a little piece that just talks about the impending launch of NF Tables, which is the IP tables replacement. So all interesting stuff. I'll be posting an interview with the president and CEO of Palo Alto Networks in our brand new podcast, Risky Business 2, early next week. So I hope you've been to risky.biz to add Risky Business 2 to your podcatcher. You can go to risky.biz/feeds for all of the new RSS feeds. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.